Welcome to a Red Production Company special podcast with the wonderful Russell T. Davis.
I would go through your list of accolades, but it's too long.
We'll go with it.
Written things such as The Return of Doctor Who in 2005.
Yeah.
We've got Years and Years out. Amazing.
Yeah,
the Boys coming up.
Yes.
Exciting.
Good times, yeah.
So, going to grill you about some writing.
Okay, mainly. Fire away.
So, how did you get started with writing? What was the moment where you went, I want to be?
Yes, I suppose I always did. Like when I was in school, I used to draw a lot and I used to write a lot and I used to write stories and things. I didn't really sort of see it as a job properly, just because I'm not from that sort of background or anything. So, and I didn't even... a lot of people don't know that writers exist. They kind of think the actors make it up, and I think that's quite a good way to live. Actually, there's no need to know that we exist. So it wasn't... I can't say I was ever sitting there in school thinking, I must be a writer. But I knew that I loved television, I knew I loved drama, I knew I loved stories, and so I got into television production. Behind the scenes on children's shows. And then I worked for a producer who used to drink quite a lot. Bless him. After 2 o'clock, he was out for the count. Those were the days. It was very old BBC. It was like that in the 80s. That's how television was.
It used to be a bar in the BBC, didn't it?
Yes. Oh, my God, yes. And at BBC Wales, there was... God, the bar was busy. These people would go for lunch and drink 8 pints of a lunchtime. Can you imagine? And then go back to their offices. That would really quite normal. That would happen at Granada as well.
It's not a productive afternoon.
The whole world was like that. That's what work was like. People would drink in the lunchtimes. Anyway, it all worked for me, and I couldn't. I tried this once. Yeah. So I went along with the lads and fell over and slept the rest of the day. I thought, I'm not doing that. Sat there with one little gin and tonic. I think that's enough for me. And which was a godsend, because then one afternoon, when you work in children's, it's very cheap and very, it's a very good place to learn your trade, actually, because there's not much money. So everyone ends up doing everything. And so it was a magazine show, which still requires a script. So he, as the producer, would write the script. And bless him, he was quite drunk. I'm saying this because he's dead now, bless him. He's passed away quite recently. And he was a lovely man called David Evans. He was lovely. I owe my entire career to him in many ways. And he had a bit to drink. And he went, oh, Russell, can you take this script home and write it? I'll give you a bit of money. I'll give you 50 quid. And that was a magazine show, but you've still got to like have intros and outros and a shape to the scene and information, and you've got to get across, etc., etc. So I wrote that. I handed that in the next day. I think I must have handwritten script. Went back into work the next day, and bless him, he read it. He went, "Oh, you can write. Oh, right. Oh, go. Do you want to do this properly? Do you want to write all of them?"
Which was really
just handing over responsibility that he had, and I did. And for like 50 quid a shot or something, I was. I started doing that, and that was the beginning of me thinking, what a nice life. Well, you can actually do this. Someone like me can actually do this.
So it was somewhat by accident rather than by design.
It was by accident. I was nonetheless in the right place, and I put myself in the right place, and I'd worked hard to put myself in the right place. But, you know, it's because I must have been, what age was I? So I was about 21, 22, 22, 23. So it was me kind of sounding out. But at the same time, it's worth saying, I was applying for every BBC training course in the land and getting turned down.
Yeah.
Me, I love television. I love television so completely. And I got turned down twice by the BBC, and I actually then wrote to the head of personnel and complained.
Oh, wow.
I complained, saying, I could not love television more. How could you turn me down? And I had a meeting with the head of personnel to talk about why they turned me down. So she said, oh, apply again. I applied for the third time. They turned me down again.
Oh.
So you just have to find your own way sometimes. Yes. It's like, that's
well,
that's
you've certainly, yes. certainly not gone badly that
and
way
later,
at all.
Later, I killed her.
Oh.
I didn't really.
Spoilers, plot twist.
It would have been great if they had risen to a position of power and pushed her off the sixth floor. That would have been magnificent.
Poetic justice.
Yeah,
poetic
I'll tell that version from now on.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Go with that.
Much better.
So you sort of mentioned that earlier that you said, you know, people often think that actors just kind of make it up on the spot. Mm. Do you have a lot of collaboration with actors when you get more to a production point of view? Do you take input, or are you more...
You do take input, not madly, to be honest, because I work very hard on getting it right. If they don't like something or if they want to say something differently... then that is fine. And I'm a genuinely listen. That tends to happen about one line every 5 years.
Yeah.
Because actually I have really, really thought about it. And I will sit with them forever and tell them why a character says something like that. I make that sound quite... It's much more collaborative and collegiate than that. It's much more friendly. But actually, I have worked hard on it, and it does sound right. And they've passed the audition, they've got the part, so they say what's on the page.
Yes, of course, definitely.
Yeah, I'll talk to them till the cows come home. I tend not to. It's like, if we look at most of the productions I've done over the past 20 years, I've not sat down with the cast and said, oh, he was born in a slum or and he went to school here or she had breakfast this morning and it was this or she likes this and that. I tend not to do that. It's like just live on the page, just live on the moment. Just that's what this scene is all about. I don't, it's not about what you had for breakfast this morning. It's not about what happened to you when you were 12. It's here and now. So yes, it's amazing how little those conversations happen. For me, if you like those conversations, you can have them.
Yes, yeah, of course. Mm. So do you have a specific, do you have a writing process? Is there something where it's, you know, a certain place that you like to write, certain time of day?
I've got, I'm very lucky, a couple of homes where I've just recreated my office exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's in same chairs, same computer. And I just sit at those. So, yeah, most of it, I think 90% of the stuff I've ever written is probably in Manchester, in the same chair. I literally haven't moved for about 25 years. There is a space where it's all been written. I can't. That's interesting, that, because I can't. Like people like Chris Chibnall, who does Doctor Who now, he always has a laptop. He sits in meetings writing, he sits on trains writing, he'll sit having a coffee with you writing. I can't do that at all. I don't bother having a laptop or an iPad because I know I can't work on them. So there's no point in having
them. So is it handwritten?
It's on the computer. But it has to be
desktop,
at my
sat,
desk.
Yes,
at my desk, yeah, completely. I don't can't even make notes or anything. It's just all there. And there's no hours are just like it's like homework. You just leave it, and then you panic at the last minute. And if I tend to work as after all these years, there's no fixed hours. There's nothing regular. I'll happily work till about 3 or 4 in the morning. It's time to work. I like that. Unfortunately, when you're in production, everyone wakes up at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and all the emails start flying. But if I can work late, then I do. That's the best time.
So I know that when people start out writing, often they draw from their own personal experiences to make storylines, to make characters. You write such a wide variety of characters, really, really diverse characters with so many different things going on. That's how nice. Do you get into the minds of so many characters?
It's interesting because I think they all sound the same person. Yeah. I think they all sound like versions of me, which they are in a way. You're absolutely right. That's kind of like, we're in a very interesting moment in writing and in fiction and in representation and identity at the moment where, you know, it's being said that you only have a valid voice if you have experienced something, which is very interesting, and that is the voice of a lack of representation. There's a lot of black people be saying that, disabled people be saying that, gay people be saying that, because they feel their voices haven't been heard, so they feel absolutely correctly that they're the ones who have to say that. Mm-hmm. Conversely, at the other end of it, from a writer's point of view, you're there to write anyone, anything.
Tolkien
couldn't not write Lord of the Rings because he wasn't a dwarf.
You
know, he had to be free to invent everything. I've not just associated all those minorities with dwarfs. They're not even that anymore. So it's a tricky one. Mm-hmm. And it's not actually tricky because I just ignore it. It's tricky when you come to discussing it in conversations like this.
Yes, of course.
Is like 0.001% of my time. The rest of the time, I just go home and, you know, by those rules, I wouldn't have invented Celeste in Years and Years, who I think is one of my favourite characters I've ever invented.
Of
a powerful female accountant of Jamaican origin who slips into Jamaican patois when she's angry. That's quite far from me, really.
Yeah,
and you know, I'd love someone to pop up and say, "Russell, you can't write that." Well, maybe they are popping up and saying that somewhere. I just don't hear them, and I won't pay any attention.
And
I do think it's a very, very great. It's actually a very serious thing. It's a very great pressure on people. It's fine. Look, I'm 56 years old. I've got a nice career. I'm tall and I'm loud, and I get into rooms and I get listened to. So I'm all right. You don't need to worry about me. Where this is a worry is very much on new writers. There's this thing called them. There's this thing called the Mary Sue approach to writing, which is that people assume your lead character is an avatar for yourself, it's a little bit true, but it's also rubbish. It's very much said by people who don't write these theories. It's like, I've yet to meet a writer who ever talks in these terms. But the critics of writing are very ferociously using that. It very much affects young women writers, this, that they become scared. There's evidence that this is happening, especially in the forms of novels and short stories. They become scared to use young female characters, or just female characters, depending on the age they are, because those characters will be seen as avatars of themselves, because they'll be seen as what's called a Mary Sue, which is just the author's representation in the piece. And so there's evidence of women not writing female characters because they think they'll be judged by that, because they think they'll be seen by that, or seen too much, and because they think they'll be criticised for that.
Yeah.
The criticism of the character becomes a criticism themselves. It's like, it's in this online world, it's like there's a million ways in which criticism is weaponized to stop people writing.
Yes, yes.
I think people who don't write are very fundamental fear, almost a superstitious fear of writers. It's a very strange thing, and will do anything they want to stop them. If they love stopping a writer in their tracks.
Yeah.
Fine for me, you can't. If you're 18, or if you're 16, if you're 13 and just starting out, those pressures are enormous.
Yes,
those pressures that say, you can't have a Mary Sue character. You can't write a character who isn't yourself. You can't write, if you're a little white kid, you can't write a black man from the 1800s. You can't. And those pressures are enormous now. Enormous. It's been very interesting to see where that takes us. Those pressures are also going to get us to some very interesting stuff, because it means that 13-year-old might think, I could only write about the life of a 13-year-old. And might come up, and some 13-year-olds will come up with something absolutely brilliant that we've never heard before.
Yeah.
Some great big piece of fiction that's a portal into the mind of a 13-year-old that'll make us go, oh my God, that's what being 13 is like. Or, I remember what being 13 is like. So all these pressures can create good things.
But
a lot of people behind them are very interested in shutting writers up. That's the worry. It was a long answer.
Yeah, I could carry on. It's wonderful. It's supposed to be free-flowing.
It's a tricky one, though. It's very, very difficult.
Because you mentioned Tolkien writing about dwarves and elves, but he's not one of them. And sort of for you writing for Doctor Who, do you feel like there is less pressure when you're writing about something that doesn't exist? So you can write about an alien and no one can ever tell you, oh, that's not how they are, because...
It's going to be said, it's like... I talk in terms of pressure. I'm under no pressure because I don't. The only thing I do online is Instagram. I just post a funny picture and run away, and say thank you to people who are nice to me and just laugh at people who are rude.
Yes.
And so I'm not. I don't live an online life. I'm not on Facebook.
Yes.
I tried Facebook. I can't bear it. I tried it recently. I tried it for my friends are all just shouting furiously online all day long. I'm disillusioned with all of them. Mm. So I can't bear it. And actually, when we talk about those pressures, that's what that pressure is. It's online. It's on Twitter, particularly, and it's on Facebook, on all those platforms. So I'm not under any pressure at all. It's like, if you'd like to sit in a room and say these things to my face, I think you'll find those people saying those things wouldn't have them. No. They crumble like talcum in the wind if they ever had a chance to say it to my face. So, but if you're 13, 14, 15, 16, then you are living an online life, and so you are going to have to listen to those pressures. And that's fine, because the ones who are made of steel will find a career. But I'm not sure writers should be made of steel. I think writers should be made of something very sensitive and soft. And
be
listening to what's going on. So it's going to be a very interesting next generation to see what writing becomes and what fiction becomes. It'll survive, just in different forms. But I wouldn't like to be young and writing my first pieces right now. Well, I would, because I just do whatever I wanted.
Well,
I was young and I did do whatever I wanted. But it's not easy, I think.
So would you say for young writers now, if they're starting out in the industry, that just trying to channel out all the noise and just get on with what they think is the right...
I think when I talk to young writers and things, it's like the... I did this talk a while ago at the Edinburgh Festival, which was... there's a great, great pressure to think, because people say to you, you have to write from your own experience... If you're 15, most 15-year-olds are sitting there thinking, I haven't lived.
Yes.
I've gone to school. I go home, I have my tea. Mm. I have my baked beans. I watch the telly. That's it. That's it. I might have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, but maybe not. A lot of them don't. It's like there's a real... And then you read interviews with... You'll read interviews with like a 16-year-old who was homeless and put on a ship and left on a beach and then saved. And you think, oh, my God, they've lived.
Yes,
you read these tragic lives. You think, oh, my God, that person's lived. How can I ever equate with that sort of person? There's an awful feeling that actually dogs you your entire adult life. I might as well be addressing this to 50-year-old writers who are sitting there thinking, oh, I haven't lived. I have no experience. When I keep told to write what you know, I don't know anything. I haven't done. The truth of it is you have. It's when people say write what you know, you don't have to have been a drug addict. You don't have to have been hanging off the edge of a cliff. You don't have to be divorced. I should have turned my phone off. It doesn't mean you need to have cataclysmic life experiences.
Yeah.
You can write about what you know if you were ever lonely in school.
Yes, yeah.
Who wasn't lonely in school? Absolutely everybody was lonely in school. I illustrated this talk with There's a very famous episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer where in the first season where someone has been so ignored in school they've become invisible.
Yeah.
It's a great episode. And I play that alongside an episode of I, Claudius, which is an old drama from the 70s, one of the greatest dramas ever made from novels by... and who wrote the novels? I can't remember the novels. Graves. But in that, Claudius, historically and fictionally within the book, is a character who survives by making himself invisible when he's young.
Yeah.
He's young, he's got a stutter. Around him, the emperors are stabbing each other and poisoning each other. And he very much kind of absents himself and becomes a witness to history. And that's exactly the same as the Buffy story.
Yeah,
about
yeah.
someone being invisible and lonely at school. Claudius does it. The person in Buffy does it. And it just and what I'm saying is, what they're doing there is something everyone has felt. And everyone has wanted to kill someone. Most of us haven't killed someone, but everyone has hated someone so much they want to kill them, especially when you're young, especially when you're 13. That's when you actually want to kill them. And everyone has been in love, and everyone's been in unrequited love.
Yeah.
So the notion, when it says write what you know, you must realise that you know an awful lot. Because you sit there thinking all day, every day.
Yeah.
It's like your relationship with your mum and dad. It doesn't have to be a tempestuous relationship. Mm-hmm. Just that little moment you fall out slightly because your mum gets on your nerves. I can write a whole play about that.
Yeah.
It's all material. So don't be... What I would say, addressing this to young writers particularly, is don't be bullied. Mm. Don't be bullied by people saying you must write what you know. And don't be bullied by your own life, by your own doubts. Don't be... If you've lived in a house and just had tea and gone to school, you were living an interesting life. You have thought interesting things. You have thought things that you can extrapolate into a great big script if you want.
Yeah.
So don't be afraid.
Because, I feel like with years and years, you've got quite a high concept, but... At the core of it is family dynamics.
Yes.
It's how the family works around the issues.
Yeah.
So with that, it is, we've all got families.
My favourite things in that are like when two sisters are talking to each other and just lose their temper with each other. Or where they're all rude about Daniel's boyfriend behind his back, because they are.
Yes.
It's what you like in families. It's the way you just take the mickey out of each other. And that comes from no other source than me simply having lived with my sisters for all these years. It's very... good stuff to tap into.
So there was something I read in a Radio Times interview that you did where when you were starting out you got told to save up money because a career in writing is difficult and you saved £20,000.
I did, yes. That was a lot then. It was a lot now.
Is that something you would say is a good piece of advice? Do you think? Ooh, because
well, it worked. Well, it's hard to say. All that shows is my determination to go and write. Once I'd realised that writing is what I wanted to do, that kind of unlocked a door, and I realised it had always been there, actually. And so then I look back at my utter determination to do this for a job, and it was quite frightening. It's like, this is like the early 90s, and all through the 90s, like Manchester was happening, and then Canal Street was taking off. Well, I wasn't going out. I literally saved my wage from the BBC. I was paid £250 a week. And I would pay my rent out of that, and I get food out of that, and I get cigarettes out of that, and that was it.
Yeah.
And I saved and saved and saved, thinking I've gotten to leave this job, and I'm just going to write. And everyone said, "Oh, you'd be poor. Everyone live in an attic and starve." And I thought, "Well, I've got to be prepared to live in an attic and starve." £20,000 then would have got me through 2 years. I thought, if I live really simply, that's still vaguely possible now if you starve yourself. But I thought I could manage it for 2 years. On that money, so that after 2 years I haven't made any progress as a writer, then I'll go back into a normal day job. But so it's not the money doesn't matter, the saving doesn't matter. It's just that you have got to be determined. I think.
Yes.
And it worked.
Fantastic! Brilliant. So you now say I've seen you say that limited series are what. And what interests you now, as opposed to continuing series?
Yeah.
Could you go into a little bit more detail about that?
Well, it's just kind of where I am right now. It always was, actually. It's when you write long running series, you're kind of hostage to ratings, But I think I spent too long on Doctor Who. Not too long. I love Doctor Who, but I spent 5-6 years on that, which is the ultimate long run. I mean, it's the longest running in the world. It's designed to run and run and run. So I think now I'm just reacting to that. I just think. You know, we've done years and years now, which is which I'm immensely proud of, and has some very strong stuff in it. Mm. I think if I'd been thinking, oh, I do this over 2 years, over 3 years, over 4 years, I think that some of the big stuff that happens wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
Like Daniel's death, for example. I think I would go, oh, let's do that in year two. Let's have Victor stranded in Europe for the whole of the first series, and then there's a big series two. Oh my God, big climax that'll bring him back. And then what you end up, the ratings haven't been very good. It's designed as a one-off. If it had been designed as a long-running series, it wouldn't have come back with these ratings. Yeah. So I would never have got to write those things. So at the moment, I think saying it's 6 or 8 episodes long, or even 4 episodes long, makes me concentrate and put everything I ever want to say into those 6 hours. To not do that is a bit more sprawling and a bit more freeform, and you have to build in structures that allow it to last. Oh, let's marry so and so and so and so, because that marriage, we can get 4 hours of entertainment out of that, and that's just a longer, looser, more sprawling format, which is great. I mean, that's something like Cold Feet, which is, I love that show. It's a perfect show, and that's exactly how that is constructed, for stories to roll and develop and sprawl over years. But it's just not, my writing's just kind of more of a clenched fist than that somehow.
Yeah, in a self-contained story.
It's tighter, yes. So, which is not, I mean, I'm not criticising Goldfield for not being tight. It's designed to roll.
Yeah. So would you ever write for cinema then? Because that is a similar kind of...
It's funny, I had an email about this morning, it's funny. I mean, I would, yes, if the right thing came along. I did a thing called A Very English Scandal, which was 3 hours long.
Yes.
And actually, you could have chopped it out right to that and made a very nice 2-hour film. But I didn't, and I never thought of that. I just tend to be, I love television, and I'm quite obsessed with television, and I watch television a lot. And even if I have spare time, if I'm sitting at home, I'm not likely to load up a movie or download a movie. I'm much more likely, I'll sit there watching old episodes of The Chase at 2 in the morning. I really, really love television. So it's kind of the way my mind works, that my ideas are kind of 6 hours long or 5 hours long or whatever. So it's tricky. However, the right idea comes along, and I think it was 2 hours long. Bang, yes, I will.
Because you also seem to write mainly for PSBs. What about streaming platforms? Is that something that
it's
you would
hard
like to
do? That's getting hard. I think people always think, it's easy. It's like, Netflix and Amazon, it's all streaming, everything's easy. Yeah. It's hard to get things made on those platforms. I actually have no experience of those platforms, to be honest. You should have a 25-year-old writer who's surfing those platforms and conquering them. That's who you should ask about that.
Yes,
I've never been on Netflix, and I've been on Amazon by association. And years is with HBO, but HBO's looking kind of old these days compared to the streaming platforms.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Obviously, it's the way things are heading.
Yeah.
And I don't worry about it too much. In the end, you've just got to go into a room and sell it to someone. So,
So for you, when you're writing, are you thinking about who's going to show it? Or is it more just, I'm writing my idea?
It helps to know, because it does change the... when did I last write something not knowing where it was going to go? You have a vague idea. It might not be where it'll end up. I mean... No, I suppose, yes, Years and Years was always the BBC. And obviously, Queer's Folk was always Channel 4. Mm. So you do have an idea.
Yeah.
It does shape which way you're doing things. But as I say, I have no idea. I've never been box-setted.
Yeah.
And I have no experience of streaming. So I don't know whether I would adapt my writing for things like that. I don't think I would. I think, much as we all love streaming, I think the curse of streaming is the episodes are just shapeless. It's a very exciting time for television. It's not perfect. You get these baggy, overblown episodes that have no beginning, have no end, they have a great end because they know the cliffhanger works.
Yeah.
And the 50 minutes before it's just been scene after scene after scene. It's shapeless. And I don't like that. And I never would write like that.
Yeah.
I'll end up out of work when I'm 60 or 70 or something because everyone's writing like that. But you cannot argue that individual episodes should have more shape and more punch and more meaning, because you never know when that will be viewed individually. Of course they should. So there's a lot of stuff being touted as good that isn't good at the moment, just because it's streaming.
So I mean, do you have any kind of condensed tips that you would give to new writers?
Oh wow,
is
Russell's condensed tips,
that's Russell's a good title, condensed isn't it? Tips. That's condensed going on tip. Instagram.
Really, the thing I always say to writers is get on with it.
Yes.
Because it's like everyone says, I'm going to write a script. I'm going to write a novel. I'm going to write this. It's like your enemy has started their novel and has almost finished it.
Yes.
It's like your rivals are ahead of you. Mm-hmm. Just remember that. No one's waiting for you. No one is waiting for you. No one's sitting there going, I'll wait for Jim to finish that script and then the whole of television will take off. Someone around the corner from someone who don't know, or someone you hate. That's the best way to imagine. Someone you hate is writing a script right now,
yeah.
and they will go and get it made. It's, you know, it is a competition. Mm-hmm. And so to be in a competition, you've got to enter the competition. You've got to be part of it. So get on with it. Stop talking about this. And I know there's so much fear. You've just got to overcome the fear. That's the thing. And then you've really got to be prepared to work all hours. I mean, it makes me laugh. I work with writers on, you know, my Doctor Who days and things like that. Writers go, "Oh, I worked till 8 o'clock last night." Yeah, and yeah. They genuinely think, "Oh, I'm so tired. I worked till 8 o'clock." It's like, frankly, then you have a sandwich and then you go back to work and you stay until about 2 o'clock and then you get up at 8 the next morning or 7 the next morning and you keep working. It's a lot of work all the time. If you're getting it right, it's a massive amount of work. You can forget holidays. You can forget Christmas because those scripts should be going through your head night and day. And if that's ringing a bell with you, if you're listening to this thinking, "Oh, I think like that, I think of my stories all the time," then you stand a chance. If that sounds a bit tiring or a bit punishing, give up now, because that's what it's like.
Because a later scene in Years and Years, I won't mention it, but you had the idea in your head between a husband and wife.
Yes.
Years and years ago.
Yes, that's amazing. I didn't realise that. The end, it's the big climax between Stephen and Celeste, which I've literally had in mind. I literally had a husband in this position with the prop that he's got in that scene, facing his wife in the middle of a depression. I have had in my mind for about 25 years. I know that because I can list the actors I thought of being in it all those years ago, who were my favourite actors 25 years ago. I'm thinking, "Oh, that'd be great with that woman and that man." And I looked them up. I looked up when I'd been inspired those actors, I looked up the series they were in and it was 25 years ago. So sometimes a scene just sits there and waits, and I can't believe it's been made now. And of course, it looks very different now to how I imagined it 25 years ago. But it is essentially the same. I read something once that said, and I'm fascinated by this recently, and I keep wondering. It said you will have every idea you'll ever have by the age of 16.
Oh wow!
And you spend the rest of your life working that out.
Yes. Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah. It's like, and it sounds like nonsense, but when you talk to people, look at it. Yeah, there's something in there. It's there's something there that ticks away. Interesting.
Because you had the idea for years and years.
Oh, it's about 20. That's about 20 years.
You were just waiting for the right time to write it. And
well, it wasn't waiting. Yes, it's not like I was busy doing other things.
Yeah.
And fortunately, unfortunately, the world got madder.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I was just thinking this morning, what would I have written if I'd written this in the year 2000? Life was a lot calmer then.
And
they said it wasn't. That's not true. I still would have written the same things. What am I on about? We'd lived through, like, that's 10 years coming out of, like, Thatcher and the miners' strikes. There's always something going on.
Yes, yeah.
It would always have been a good idea.
But it was that moment at the election of Trump where you sent the email to the BBC this is the moment.
That's a turning point in our history. That is, it lived for all of us, for good or ill, no matter what you think of it. Mm-hmm. That's when the world changed, the entire world, when that man was elected.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So the story writing process is not just a linear. We sit down in a room, we write for a few months. It's always going on.
No, it's always in flux. That's why. I mean, I'm very lucky in that. I'm in a lucky position now. I mean, any young writers listening to this, coming up with ideas, will be asked to hand in. You might write episode one, and then you'll be asked to hand in synopsis for the rest of the series. I never do that.
Yeah.
I haven't done that. I don't think I've ever done it. Somehow, I got away without ever doing it. Surely I did it for Queer as Folk or something. I didn't at all. I just said, "Oh, trust me, it'll be good." I talk about stories that were to come, but that breakdown of episodes 2 to 6, I just thought, no, that kills it dead. Why would I do that? Why would I do all that hard work on like 4 sheets of A4? I'll go and write it. Let me go and write it. That's what comes to life. I've got to say, you're very lucky if you can get away with that. I wouldn't take that as advice, because I think these days you have to prove, here's all 6 hours. But because there is no fixed story. I didn't know exactly what happened at the end of Years and Years episode 6 until I came to write it, which always makes people say, it makes it sound as though it's made up as it goes along. First of all fiction is made up as it goes along. Yep. That's what fiction is. But also, I've actually been thinking about that for 24 hours a day for the past year.
Yes, yeah.
It's like, that's where that if you want it written down on a sheet of A4, it is in my head. Those sheets of A4 are in my head. They just die once you put them onto paper. But,
Because you even had the initial idea for the shock at the end of Ep 4. wasn't going to be Daniel, was it? It was going
to
be...
No, that went through two versions. Yeah. That was when I did pitch the show to the BBC. I don't write things down, but I do sit there and tell the story and say, and Daniel and Victor crossed the channel. And originally it was Victor who died. They sold the series to the BBC on the strength of Victor dying. And then I came to write it. It was before I wrote it. It was about a month before I wrote it. I kind of went, it's just not shocking. Mm. It's just not powerful enough because... it's a refugee. It's like you created him to die within the drama. It's like that's what refugees do in dramas like this. And the whole point of the show is for a normal British family to suffer the shocks and privations and terrors that people go through abroad, that we think of as being foreign. We think of the thing that happened abroad, the poverty and the terror and the fleeing and the homelessness and the need to migrate. We think of that as other.
Yes.
And it's that you put a British family through that. So that's why you look at it in its purest form, you think, that's why a member of the family has to go through that migration, has to go through that cross-channel journey and has to die.
Yes.
So yeah. It was kind of obvious, really, when you look at it. But it took a while to get there.
I've noticed recently there has been kind of almost inevitability about other things. So watching Avengers Endgame, it very much felt like Iron Man. Of course, Iron Man had to be the one to die.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes.
Because he's the one with the child, and therefore he was the one with the most to lose from it.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes.
So
yes,
it was
yes,
a similar
yes.
kind of.
And he was kind of born dying in a way, wasn't he? With his bad heart in that cave in Iraq or wherever he was. He came out of death, didn't he?
It was the same with...
It's interesting, though. If you'd done it the other way around...
Yes.
I mean, that's what stories do. They just adapt and they make sense afterwards. If Captain America had died... I remember going to see that film with friends of mine who were convinced that Captain America died. I was sitting there going, in the age of Donald Trump, he's called Captain America. Do you think the American hero is going to die in an American film? It was so stupid. And exactly that was it. But say Captain America had sacrificed himself, then we'd all be sitting in there going, well, of course he was born out of his time.
Yes.
He was never meant to be here. He shouldn't be in the modern world. He always belonged there. So of course he gave his life. So stories just make sense on their own. You know, if you write it well enough, if whatever happens is believable, all the sense comes with it.
Yes, and we can look at it with hindsight and put the bits together.
Could have done it with anyone. Could have had Gwyneth Paltrow sacrifice. Like, we'd all go, that's why she was so underwritten for all those films. That's why she was never sent to stage. Finally, she got sent to stage. See, I'm not being sarcastic. You could do this with any character. It would happen.
Is that almost making everything too academic then? And
no, it's not academic. It's like the opposite of academic. It's like that. That's kind of engaging with the story on a really primal level. If it's good, if it's well told... And that, my God, that film is well told. I think it's a masterpiece, that film. Absolute masterpiece. Then your audience will bring all this reckoning with it. It might not be necessarily true that the writer sat there going, it has to be this. Has to be, you know, they might be sitting there going, well, Robert Downey Jr.'s contract is up, so we have to kill him. Yeah. And I mean, they're better writers than that. That's not true. But nonetheless, put anyone dying in that position, in that film, any major character, Thor, Asgard is gone. The gods are gone, his father's gone, his mother's gone. Of course it has to be Thor. Anything would make sense if it's well written.
Yes, yeah.
So you don't have to be trapped by a story. Mm. That's what I mean about not writing them down, not doing treatments, not doing outlines of episodes, because I think you get trapped by them. I think once it's in black and white, saying in episode 4, Victor will die, then you kind of streamline yourself towards them. Everything starts making sense in episode 1 towards that, and you got a little bit stuck.
Yeah.
You haven't got the option for anything to happen, because in life, anything happens. Mm.
Yeah. So do you think that freedom to not have to write down your synopsis, your treatment outlining the whole series, is that from having working relationships that you've built up throughout your career?
Because, yes.
I mean, when we're accepting scripts, we're looking, you know, it says we want the first episode and a synopsis.
And a synopsis. I mean, it does come from being trusted, and it comes from delivering. Mm. And I always, you know, it doesn't matter whether you like the stuff or not, I always deliver. Mm. I always deliver on time. And working with Red, and I work with other people as well, the production's always to a high standard, I think, and it's well cast. So that gets you work. Work creates work in that sense. And there's a list of people who don't deliver. people whose names you don't even know, because they're not, they've stopped, I can name careers that have juddered to a halt because they don't deliver. And it's a very hard job. I don't blame people for not doing that sometimes, for not delivering. It can be really, really tough, and there are people who just whose careers falter if they haven't done it. So I know how lucky I am, but I know how hard I've worked for it.
Yes, of course, so you executive produce a lot of your shows as well. Is that something that you feel need to be involved in all the way through? You can't just hand off a script and go...
I do. Sometimes I think, wouldn't that be nice? Mm. And I might one day. And it's very collaborative. It's very collegiate, the whole thing. It's not like being a dictator. But, you know, I've written it. It's like, if you want an expert in the script, it's me.
Yes,
everyone's there to make the script. They've got these 60 pages to be made. Who do you want to talk to? Me.
Yeah.
Of course you do. And also, I want to talk, you know, that's where it's collaborative. It's like you get a costume designer who'll think of something I'd never thought of.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
You know, why don't they wear this, why don't they wear that? And that's when it comes alive. That's how brilliant. And then you get an actor who comes in who would do a completely different spin on it. Actually, Celeste is a good example of that. I wouldn't have thought of giving someone Jamaican patois in something. And if you wouldn't have thought of it, and I'd worked with Tania before, and she arrived at the read-through for episode one, and she sits down with Sharon Duncan Brewster, who plays Fran, and the two of them riff and spin off into Jamaican all the time. And I was like, oh, that sounds brilliant.
Yeah.
And more importantly, I was thinking, that's not been heard on BBC One before. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it has, but I don't think it's been heard from a middle-class character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A woman who's an accountant with a family and kids ripping off into that patois. I just thought, that's brilliant. So actually, I sat down with her and said, what lines can we change and where can we put that in? And she loved that. So yes, there is collaboration there. So there's that sort of collaboration with everyone and everything, and that way the whole thing gets richer. And when that works, it all really comes together. Yeah.
So that's at the read-through. Do you go on set a lot, or is that something you can't?
I didn't used to. To be honest, yeah. I learnt my trade going on set. Yeah. Queer as Folk was there every single day.
Yeah.
And you do. It's a very, very brilliant thing for a writer to do. You just learn the pressures of the day. You learn that it doesn't matter if someone's wearing a blue shirt instead of a red shirt. You learn the practicalities of the whole thing. You learn how actors behave. You know, it's not all fun being on set. It's a workplace.
Yes,
and there are protocols.
Yeah.
And it's good to learn. And it's good to learn the practicality. My favourite quote is that someone once said, apparently about Thornton Wilder, they said, Thornton Wilder is a good playwright because he knows how long it takes to cross from one side of the stage to another. And that's good advice.
Yes.
Because I can't tell you how often you read a script that says he gets to the car and drives away. Do you know how long that takes? To get into a car and drive away. Seriously, you get into a car, think about it, you get into the car and you might take your jacket off and then you get a seatbelt, and I'm speeding this up,
and then you
put in the ignition and you might turn the radio on, bye-bye, you wave. I mean, that was 30 seconds. Actually, really, physically, you're talking about 1.5 minutes, 2 minutes. You have to learn not to do that.
Yes.
You have to learn that's actually, or you know, that's where a director ends up getting cross and making all sorts of, you know, you can cut away to this and cut away to that. Or if you have to do that, then put some dialogue in it. Have some dialogue being exchanged during that. That's actually really important. But you learn that kind of stuff on set that really, really, is she walking up to the door? Is she already there? Is she, I can't tell you, you see it not being thought through every single day on television. And this happens, I have to stop this on set happening, which is that someone says their last line of dialogue and then they walk away. Mm-hmm. That's in every drama transmitted every night. And it's like, and that wasn't the last line. You know, a scene would have been written so that I'd have said, all right, thank you for this podcast. And I walked out. That wouldn't be my last words to you.
I'd
say, oh, I'll see you later then. Bye-bye. And when's this going out? And have a coffee. And off we go. Hmm. That's what real life is like. It's so often on television. I keep an eye out for that. Someone delivers their last line. And so, doctor, we'll have to operate. Then they walk away and everyone sits in silence because they haven't got any lines. And the person going out the door hasn't got any lines. And the people sitting there haven't got any lines. And it's ridiculous. It's really, really bad. We see it happen so often that we kind of think it's natural. Mm-hmm. Along with people saying, I need some air. That's not natural. But I don't think anyone in real life ever said that until people started saying it on television just because the writer couldn't find a way for them to exit. And now you've seen that on television so much that people now do say, I'm going to get some air when they leave the room. It's like, who needs air? There's air in here. So it's like, anyway, that's a long tangent. But yes, being on set as often as you can is a great thing, and any writer should ask for that.
Yeah.
If you just had your brand new first episode commissioned, asked to go on set. If you're on set, it's tricky on things like that are big treadmills like soap operas because you're a tinier cog in there.
Yes, yeah.
It might be your script, but there's a million scripts. But even then, you should. Sally Wainwright tells very good stories about asking to go on set. That's when she met Sarah Lancashire for the first time on set. And look at the working relationship they forged out of that one simple little meeting. So yes, go as often as you can. Now I visit, but I'm not saying I've learnt it all, but actually I'm now in my time of life better served by being at my desk writing.
Yeah, getting more scripts out.
Yeah.
I remember it made me think of, I saw a very old episode of Doctor Who when it was still in black and white.
Oh,
and it said, like, make sure you go back for the girl in the red jumper. And you're kind of going,
really?
Yeah, so when you said that it doesn't matter whether we're in a blue shirt or a red shirt, I was like, well, I mean, we don't know.
We can guess. Black and white.
I assume at some point earlier in the episode they'd gone, oh, nice red jumper.
Nice red jumper, Zoe. Or something.
Throw it in just to drive the story. It was it did definitely tickle me.
I thought I could name any episode. I don't know which one that
episode.
Is.
Any episode. This was from, you know, the 60s.
Yeah, but, I know that. I was there.
You've done your research.
I've watched them, yeah.
It was like when you were quizzing me on time travel in Avengers Endgame. I was like, I don't know. You tell me.
There's a few gaps there.
Yeah, yeah. The master of time himself.
Hardly.
So you've got work, you know, working relationships sort of with us and
yes,
with the BBC.
Yes.
Do you find that you like working with the same actors again as well? Is this
I do. Yes. Oh, gosh. You have to watch that. You also want to be a bit of a tart, to be honest, and discover something new and surprise yourself and excite yourself with something you didn't see on the horizon kind of thing. But equally, when you work with a great editor, when you work with like Rory Kinnear or Russell Tovey or Leslie Sharp or David Tennant, all those people, Billy, those people I've been lucky enough to work with, Freema, it's, yes, you know, you cling to them as much as you can because, again, it's delivering.
Yes, yeah.
It's like you can meet a great actor sometimes, you sort of think, well, are you a drunk? Will you have bad moods on set? Are you going to be a nightmare? And it's will you say the lines like I think they should be said? So, that's why you do use the great names over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's true. You should. Yeah, we talk about this a lot in the office, actually, whether it's like, have we seen that face before? Does it look too similar to a previous production? It's a tricky one. But everyone in work works with people that they like.
Yes.
If you work in a bank, it's like, oh, get Charlie in because Charlie's lovely and you have a nice time with Charlie and he does the work on time. So it's every job does that. It's just very visible when it comes to actors.
Yes, and I've noticed, looking at Twitter for years and years, one of the ones is working with Murray Gold.
Yes.
Everyone is getting kind of nostalgic flashbacks to the Doctor Who era that you ran because it's...
Oh, with years and years?
Yes, because of the music accompanying it. So it's not it's not just the actors in it. It's, it's that kind of...
It's that energy, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's been and I think nowadays people are a lot more switched on about soundtracks than they used to be. I think there's more of a kind
of... Yes, it's interesting because every time... Because actually, it's the director's choice in the end. It's very hard to employ a good director and say, you must use this musician. It has to be the director's choice. So almost every show I've ever worked on for the past 20 years, the director's walked in saying, I'll do my own thing with music. I'll find someone brilliant. And you sit there going, yes, okay, there's a really good man called Murray Gold. It really suits my work, if you'd like to be. And they come up with all these names, and they come up with all these suggestions, and no one is ever as good.
Yes, yeah.
And Paul Murray, it's like he has to jump through hoops. It's like he has to audition every single time. Mm. Not quite, to be honest. He's a bit more grand than that.
Yeah.
But it's not automatic. Mm. And it's very interesting to watch directors going through the options, going through other great musicians or brand new musicians, listen to their scores, listen to their tracks, and in the end, watching my stuff and going, actually, it's Murray.
Yeah.
He gets it and he does it best every single time. And you know, years and years is something, I still think it's an astonishing score. It takes me by surprise. It's like, it's a Bulgarian choir. What's a Bulgarian choir going to do with that subject matter? But it fits, doesn't it? That's why he's so clever. So I sit there being surprised by it. And after 20 years, I'm still shocked by what he's coming up with. That's a good sign, I think. And he's doing the next thing as well. Finally, on the next thing, we're doing this story about AIDS in the 80s of Channel 4. Marvelous director just went, oh, yeah, of course it's Murray.
Yes.
He just walked in and went, of course we've been playing Murray Gold. Yes. Hooray.
So I guess the soundtrack will take probably a slightly different approach.
Oh, God,
to that,
different. Yes, there's a different feel to it. I mean, you look at what Murray did with A Very English Scandal. That was completely different to what he's doing now. I mean, I think years and years has got that futuristic vibe. So I can see now why people are saying it's a bit Doctor Who-y. Interesting. Yeah, nice. Good. No greater compliment.
Well, no, definitely not. So The Boys...
Which will have to change title. Yeah, there's another series on Amazon, I think, called The Boys, which is an old... Is it a Mark Miller title? It's not Mark Miller, it's someone else. It's Grant Morrison or one of those.
Yeah.
It's an old comics title, isn't it? So we can't think of another title. We're really stuck.
Your next show.
The next show, yes.
Is this an important one for you to write? Do you feel, because of the subject matter?
Yes. I do, actually. Yes, it's like I'm mid-writing it now. And there were a couple of times when I have a little word with myself where I sit there thinking, oh, I could have a chase now. I could do this, I could do that. And it's interesting. It's interesting to write that it's the story of AIDS in the 1980s in Britain.
Yes.
Which is a story that people think has been told, and it hasn't, actually. Mm. And there were a couple of moments I sit there thinking to myself, thinking, this isn't about you now, Russell. Shut up. There were moments where I might go off into one of my, oh, there's my phone, how terrible. Who's phoning me? It's probably them. When I might go off into one of my riffs about something, I'm like, no, 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 you're here to, this is a really shocking story. Just tell the story, just do that. Yeah. So it's fascinating. It's barely halfway through yet, but no, I'm loving it. It. It's going to be very strong stuff.
Yeah. It's a story that you think really, really needs to be told.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's also going to be, it's also in the 80s, and the characters are all young. It's going to be sexy. It's going to be, it's genuinely, it's the story of three, I say sexy, it's a story about sex.
Yes, yeah.
And I cannot just so show sex as a deadly thing in it.
Yes.
It's got to be these 18-year-old boys discovering life and discovering their sexuality and discovering the joy of it as well at the same time that a killer disease comes along. So it's hopefully got both in it, but while being absolutely responsible and sober about the story and shocking about the story. Mm. Some shocking things happen. You get to tell stories you can't believe, and that's great for a script, frankly. You sort of think, God, the shocking things that happen, it's being forgotten, you know? Yeah. I think if you're 18 years old, I think you kind of referred to AIDS in the past tense, and you aren't aware of how many people died, how many young men died. Anyway, it's a great story. So, yes, that's underway now.
I will wrap it up because you need to go for lunch.
Thank you. Yes.
Don't you?
Yeah. About the project, yes.
Yes, about the project.
Work, work, work.
Working straight on the back, working lunch. I mean, at least lunch. You know.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for listening. It's been absolutely wonderful to have Russell T. Davis with us. And follow our podcast, follow our social media accounts, and you'll keep up to date with when we're going to release new podcasts. Thank you very much.